Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated war history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, historians, and politicians, and we talk about wars and history. Today's guest is Cy Shepherd, Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Long Island University, which is pretty cool. He has a doctorate from Johns Hopkins University, and he's written multiple publications about political history from ancient times to modern times, and he's also the author of today's book, Crescent Dawn, The Rise of the Ottoman Empire and the Making of the Modern Age. Cy, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so we don't actually get to talk about this era a lot on this show, so this is going to be really cool for our listeners. And I just want to kind of open up here and set the stage. We're talking about the Ottoman expansion. Can you just lay out very brief overview of what that even is and when it is?
Sure. So we talk about the modern age a lot. I teach classes about the modern age, the modern world. And my big question was always, where did that come from? And here in the West, we're familiar with the basic story. Everybody knows the names of Christopher Columbus, Vasco da Gama, the other great figures of the Age of Discovery, as it's called. But looking deeper into how and why those individuals did what they did, looking into the forces that impelled them to do that, and stripping away some of the assumptions we have about the construct of the modern age being effectively built from the basement up by Europe. It was a Western phenomenon. If we look closely at it, it really wasn't. The Western forces, Europe as we call them, was clearly critical to this process. But Europe prior to that had actually been very marginal. And again, from a Western perspective, we know names like Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar.
Sure.
But in their absence, the real weight of demographics, of population and commercial activity and wealth and privilege were heavily stacked within Eurasia, further east. The great emporiums of India and China, that was where the money was. And why the Europeans, during the 15th to 16th century, broke out of the cul-de-sac that was Europe, backed up against the Atlantic Ocean, which previously had been like this impenetrable barrier, the end of the world.
Yeah.
They were forced into doing that. They didn't want to do that. Nobody really wants to take risks and gambles on that scale. This was like the Apollo program at multiple different levels, because the Europeans were aware the money was out there, and they were aware they were cut off from it. This increasing and expanding new power in what we call the Middle East, the Ottomans, threatened to choke them off completely from the spices, from the silks, from the real money-generating centers of activity. So they were forced into transforming the Atlantic Ocean from a barrier into a superhighway. They were forced to innovate. It took generations to do this, to come to terms with the winds and the currents, learn how to use the Atlantic Ocean. Having failed to fight their way through the Turks, if that alternative doesn't work, what can you do? You go around them. And this is what forced them into discovering how to get around Africa. It's what impelled Christopher Columbus to head west to get to the Indies. This was a commercial enterprise, and these power-hungry and money-hungry potentates of Europe were forced into this process. So I wanted to center the Ottomans back into this transformative event, the making of the modern world, of globalization, and of the system as we understand it today.
I love that. I love your kind of comparison to the Apollo program. That's such a great comparison, because you think, sure, there were people that were excited about new opportunities, but it really was like, is this going to work out? How many of us are going to die? Are we going to lose all our money? And a lot of times companies did lose all of their money. So that's a really cool comparison. And also, so that brings me up to how you describe this as really the first global war, even before the Seven Years' War in the 18th century, which is sometimes described as the first, everyone's like, oh, the first global war. But this here, we are bringing the American colonies into it a little bit, and it's like kind of everywhere. Can you just tell us a little bit about how it's the first global war, really?
Definitely, there have been multinational empires in the past. The big one, for example, the Mongol Empire of the Khans, which at one end, its eastern flank, was fighting the samurai of Japan. At the other flank in the west was fighting the Teutonic Knights of Europe. Now, those two identities, the samurai and the Teutonic Knights, had no idea of each other's existence. The only common factor was that the Mongols had been enemies of them both at the same time. By the 16th century, it was possible for policymakers in places like Lisbon, Vienna, and of course in Constantinople, in modern Istanbul, to think about geostrategy at a global level. Right? The Portuguese, in the loosest sense, were allied with various other powers in a policy of containment. Now, we're familiar with that phrase in reference to the Cold War. It was the cornerstone of US policy after World War II, the containment of Soviet expansion globally. And that was not a new phenomenon. And again, the loosest sense, very patchy. Of course, given the scale and the limitations on communications, it was difficult to coordinate this. But in the broadest sense, there was a coalition of interests which simultaneously, all around the world, in Europe, in Africa, in India, working to contain the expansion of the Ottoman Sultanate because they had a collective interest in doing so. A very diverse coalition, as I say, very patchy. But it was definitely there. So this was the first, as I see it, truly global confrontation.
Yes. And just to give people an idea of the size, the sheer size of the Ottoman Empire is pretty big. Which would you say was bigger, the Ottoman Empire or the Western Roman Empire at its peak?
The
Which
Ottoman Empire, I would call that
the
one.
Ottoman
It
Empire.
incorporated the entire southeast corner of Europe, three quarters of the Mediterranean coastline, and then, of course, deep into what we now call Arabia, Iraq, and holding that on a much longer term basis than the Roman Empire was ever capable of doing.
Quite huge, quite huge. And so, okay, so let's get into some of the major characters that we're talking about here. One of the major guys is Charles V, King of Spain, Holy Roman Emperor. This guy, there's some opinions about this guy. What's your take on him? Was he a good guy or just super unlucky or what's his kind of thing?
None of the key characters, and there's some marvelous books that focus on the key personalities. Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, his rivals, King Francis of France, and his kind of frenemy, Henry VIII of England, and of course, Suleiman the Magnificent, the Sultan of the Ottomans, all contemporaries. None of them you'd call moral from a kind of holistic point of view. All of them driven by imperatives, they all inherited immense power and privilege. And sought to do the best they could for their states within that kind of framework. Charles, very young, still a teenager, when he inherited or bought or bribed his way into this incredible power, inheriting thrones and then, of course, buying the title of Holy Roman Emperor. And then that did give him, potentially, perhaps the first individual since Charlemagne, the capacity to unite all of Europe under his collective leadership. Now, of course, what does that do? In France, that rings alarm bells. The French are now surrounded by Habsburg power. The British are looking on, obviously, potentially looking for advantage, but otherwise. But he was compromised by multiple factors. He had all that power, and if he could have brought it to all of that power to bear against one opponent, he could certainly have taken them out, or at least held his own. But he was constantly being pulled in multiple directions. He's constantly putting out fires. He's got to deal with the French. He's going to hold down the Italian possessions. He's got the Ottomans chewing their way up through the Balkans. And then out of nowhere, the great challenge to his authority internally, this complete nobody named Martin Luther nails his theses to the doors of a cathedral and sparks the Protestant Reformation, which of course divides his empire internally. And one of the other delicious features to come out of this is again the irony that Protestantism in many ways owes perhaps even its existence to the Ottoman Turkish Empire. Because every single time Charles wanted to unite all of Germany against the Turks, the Protestant magnates would be like, we want guarantees first. Money down later, we want the guarantees first. He was constantly engaged in this process of negotiation. So you can sense out of this Charles's frustration, just what it looks like. He solved one problem, something will flare up somewhere else. It's no wonder he eventually abdicated, surrendered all his crowns, retired to a monastery to do his gardening for the last few years of his life. Totally burned out.
I don't blame him at all. Like, that sounds like, okay, I'm gonna go to a monastery. No, my phone's off the hook. Don't call me. So that's, I wanted to ask about that, where the Protestant Reformation, so that's like really at the heart of his kingdom, his empire, and he's got that coming up, and the Turks at the same time. And how much do you think that the success and the spread of the Protestant Reformation owes its success to the fact that they were fighting the Turks at the same time? Do you think it could have been as successful without that?
I don't think so, because whatever Charles was able to concentrate on his Protestant problem, the so-called Schmalkaldic League, for example, the League of Protestant Princes determined not to be suppressed, he was able to defeat them. He had them at his mercy. But then again, the external forces intervened. And the role of France in this is critical. We talk about a common enemy making for strange bedfellows, and that's certainly what happened. The French, first of all, the Catholic French ally with the Sunni Ottoman Turks against their fellow Catholic Holy Roman Emperor. And then it's the French who are bankrolling the Protestant rebels against that same Holy Roman Emperor. At the same time, the kings of France are ruthlessly suppressing Protestantism in their own domain.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, if you like, blatant hypocrisy and pure self-interest that's baked into this process. Because at the same time that they're doing that, they're reaching out to the Ottomans' mortal enemies who emerged during the same period, which is the Safavid dynasty of Persia, which of course was Shia, and that meant that there was an internal war within Islam playing out just as it's happening within Christianity.
So many layers to unpack here too. And so how scandalous was that French alliance at the time? Were people just
It was the scandal of Europe. Yeah, the Pope, everybody was horrified at the French literally housing the fleet of Barbarossa Redbeard, the legendary, notorious scourge of the Christian Mediterranean. He overwintered at a French port because they were allies and they had a common enemy at that time. So
that just goes to show you too, kind of like what you were saying in the book, it's not quite this super clear division along like you're in this culture and you're in this culture over here. It was like kind of a blending, I guess, where other interests were more important to people.
Yes. In the end, the ultimate frustration for the Ottomans was they couldn't quite seal the deal in terms of their expansion. To the east, they were blocked. The rise of the new Persian dynasty, the Safavids, meant there was incessant war along that frontier that could never be resolved. Wars would rock back and forth, but the boundary was essentially set. The other frustration was the last piece in the puzzle in North Africa. The Ottomans took Egypt in modern terms. They took Libya, they took Tunisia, they took Algeria. The last piece in the puzzle was Morocco, where the Saadian dynasty held out. If the Ottomans had been able to take Morocco, they would have had a frontage on the Atlantic Ocean. The implications of that are astounding. At a minimum, they'd have been in a position to cut off the treasure fleets bringing back the loot the conquistadors were extracting from the New World. Potentially, they could have set up Ottoman colonization here in the Americas, and again, the trajectory of history would be very different.
Totally different. Yeah. So I was going to ask about that Morocco being so important here in this story because it was this access point. It was like this last. How close were the Ottomans to gaining that Atlantic access?
I think it's 50-50. The problem with the Ottomans is, of course, the same thing that Charles V had. The more your empire expands, the more frontiers you have to stamp out fires in. And of course, they're being pulled in multiple directions, too. They have the Balkans to hold down, the Black Sea with the rise of Muscovy. To the east are the Persians. Beyond that is the Indian Ocean, where the Portuguese have sunk their claws into India. Further south, there are Ottoman interests in Africa. And again, to talk about the multidimensionality of this conflict, you have Portuguese and Ottoman-backed proxies fighting a war in the highlands of Ethiopia. Finally, you had the Moroccan problem too. So again, if the Ottomans are able to concentrate all their firepower, so to speak, during the 16th century on Morocco, they may well have been able to claim it, either internally through political marriage or other alliances, or if necessary, by force. But that Moroccan independence, even to the beginning of the 16th century, the Sultan of Morocco was reaching out to Queen Elizabeth I of England for a joint campaign against their common enemies, which is, of course, King Philip II of Spain. So that pivotal factor will be very important moving forward.
It's such an interesting thought experiment to contemplate how things could have turned out differently if the Ottomans had established a foothold in the Americas early on. what sort of alliances would people have made? What sort of, you know, maybe the Spanish Empire would have been a little bit more lenient with people taking parts of the Caribbean. Like, who freaking knows? Like, that is such an interesting thought experiment. And yeah, and the other thought experiment I had with this too, which is something I could probably think about for hours and hours and hours, is what could have happened, let's say that the Protestant Reformation hadn't taken place, and there was still, there was a stronger sense of Catholicism in Europe throughout time, and how would that have affected things like King James II being run off the throne because he's, in part, because he's too lenient to Catholics, or, you know, just different aspects of English history and French history, and just, you could think about that forever. And it's mind-blowing a little bit that we don't know generally more about the Ottoman expansion because of how influential it was on all of these things, these ripple effects. I think it's an interesting read. Your book can really make you think for a while about this kind of stuff. I wanted to ask, okay, so Ottomans and the French in this weird, scandalous alliance, what would that have looked like on the ground with these soldiers? Would they have gotten along or clashed a lot? Did they fight together?
Yes, they did serve in joint campaigns, which turned out to be unprofitable, not because of any lack of commitment on the part of the leaders, but because the situation on the ground wasn't favorable. Barbarossa didn't like being so far from his home bases, wanted to stay close to North Africa, where his actual power and sources of funds were derived from. In many ways, the Ottomans were in a partnership with the Barbary Corsairs, as the Europeans called them. They ruled their own little petty states along the north coast of Africa collectively. They were under the Ottoman umbrella, but they were in many ways free agents whose driving force in the end was profit. Of course, they liked to fight for the faith. They enjoyed the titles the Ottoman sultans would bestow upon them. But they were out for plunder. And in the process, they would depopulate entire islands of their entire communities to sell
That's
them into
crazy.
The slave markets, to drive that profit motive.
That is wild. And, okay, so I also like to ask people about sources and firsthand accounts especially. Were there any firsthand accounts of soldiers that from that time that just stick out to you a little bit of their personal experience?
There were some firsthand, and I tried to quote as many as possible. In, for example, the Siege of Rhodes, the soldiers there in 1522 as the Knights Hospitaller the Knights of St. John are trying to hold on to this island, which has been their home for many generations. It gives you the intensity of this conflict because the artillery bombardments, the Ottomans were able to mobilize against key targets, Constantinople, Rhodes, Malta later, are on a scale unprecedented in human history. Again, the assumption based upon recent history is that the West was responsible for the revolution in military affairs. The West had integrated capacity for innovation in firearms technology, for example. Again, that's fundamentally untrue. The kind of artillery parks the Ottomans could bring to a set peace campaign was unlike anything anyone had ever seen before. It was the most, as well as the largest professional army in Europe at that time. And again, the impression I have constantly is that the Western powers are on the back foot. They're constantly scrambling to put alliances together, to put men, ships in the field to hold off this threat. And the constant divisions in Western Europe prevented that from happening. Again and again, the popes would desperately invoke the legacy of the Crusades. But what's striking is, more often than not, that would fail to generate any real response. The Genoese and the Venetians, for example, you couldn't put together a coalition, allied Christian fleet in the Mediterranean without those two, and they despised each other. They were mortal rivals for commercial interests. They were constantly at war with each other. Putting them on the same page would be extremely difficult. So it was very rare that happened. The victory they were able to secure at the Battle of Lepanto, one of the most famous, to me, is one of the least consequential battles in history. Of course, the Europeans celebrated it to the rafters because for once, we actually won. Let's win one for the team, for the good guys. Right. We celebrated all over Europe. It accomplished nothing. The Holy League was put together to save Cyprus, which was under siege by the Ottomans. It failed. By the time the battle took place, Cyprus had already surrendered. The Ottomans, the following year, just put a new fleet into the field and they took or retook Tunis in 1574. So the momentum was all in one direction during this period.
Fascinating. Yes. And what kind of other alliances are the major ones that we're talking about here with the Holy Roman Empire? What kind of other powers did they really depend on?
In again, the broader sense, the most important was Portugal, because the Habsburgs, originally Charles V, and then when he abdicated, he devolved responsibility in Austria to his brother, and then in Spain to his son. Now, the Portuguese were always aware, the Habsburgs, the Spanish, constantly leaning on them. They would move in if they could, and they ultimately did. But Portugal was the critical ally for Habsburg interests during this period. Because of the Spanish, Habsburgs were blocking the Ottoman expansion westward. The Portuguese, who circumnavigated Africa and settled in India, they were the ones blocking the Ottomans from expanding eastward. The Ottomans did move into the Red Sea, into the Persian Gulf, at least it's...
Yeah.
They were looking to get into, to lock into, that Indian Ocean trade. And the Portuguese just beat them to it. Another generation, it might have been too late. The Portuguese just got there first and were able to hold the Ottomans off in a series of terrible naval battles and sieges from being able to dominate the Indian subcontinent.
Very consequential. And that's another country that you don't really hear about that often in how much they impacted the world's Portugal. And, you know, obviously with certain things in the Americas, of course, but things like this, like, I don't think that they get enough credit for that. And it really is fascinating. Some of the, like, what's some of the bigger map changes that, let's say you can look at the map right now of Europe, what are some of the things that might have changed that we can still see because of this Ottoman expansion?
The high tide was at Vienna in 1529. And as much as anything else, perhaps more, the Europeans got lucky because the weather was atrocious that year. I looked into the figures, and I think I'm the first person to make this connection. I looked into the records. One of the absolute worst winters of that century was that very year. When the Ottomans set off, marched out of Constantinople, the records indicate, and the diary entries, even the Sultan's, make the same case. Constant rain. The rivers were rising and flooding and washing away bridges. The roads got so bogged down in mud, the Ottomans had to leave their heavy siege guns behind. They couldn't move them forward. So when they got to Vienna, all they had was their light field artillery, and they couldn't bring down the walls. Vienna was a backwater in many ways. It was not a frontline city. The defenses had been run down for years. It was still a medieval wall, didn't have the latest Renaissance features of defensive systems. So the defense was not great in numbers and was in a poor position. But again, the rain continued. The trenches were flooded. The tunnels were flooded. The guns couldn't make an impression on the walls. And then a very early winter came in, and driven by the climate more than anything else, Suleiman had to break off the siege and withdraw to Constantinople. If Vienna had fallen, the Habsburg capital, it might have set off a chain reaction that would just discredit the dynasty to the point where there may have been some major reaction against that.
Yeah, and like, who knows what kind of, again, what kind of tumbling through time that could have changed everything. It's so crazy.
The butterfly effect, and there are major butterflies scattered all through the story. Very significant.
Yes, that's true. But major butterfly effect points throughout the Ottoman expansion story. So fascinating. And it really does, again, highlight kind of how you were saying that there isn't like my culture versus your culture clashes. It was more like economic interests clashing and power interests clashing, which again would tie back to the economic interests, I would say. So it's really, really interesting that it's not quite as somebody might think on first blush. And are there things that people, other than those things, that people get wrong about the Ottoman expansion and the Ottoman Empire?
That's probably the most significant one. The idea that this was some grand multi-century stage jihad against the West. That was never the case at all. The Ottomans were very cosmopolitan in terms of the structure of their empire.
Yeah.
And there was no sense of ethnic bigotry. Converts from Christianity to Islam were major figures. rising to the ranks of the exalted title of Grand Vizier of the Empire itself. It's effectively the second most important man of the Empire, would be a convert. There was no distinctions about that. And in fact, until the Ottomans blew out the Mamluks, who governed the Middle East up until 1517, the empire was minority Muslim. So it had to reflect that multiculturalism to be effective. And the extent to which, another feature that's not recognized, is the quality of Ottoman leadership. When you look at the succession of sultans during this period, they have names like the Thunderbolt, the Grim, the Conqueror, the Magnificent, and they were fully entitled to those. They were outstanding administrators, and they were brilliant strategic thinkers and tactical innovators on the battlefield. So the succession of top-tier leadership is very impressive, to the point where after Suleiman, his last remaining son, because of the snake pit politics of the Ottoman succession, Selim the Sot, as he was called, even with a figure who was not of the same quality, through a sense of inertia, the empire, the bureaucracy, civil and military, was able to keep the empire functioning, even expanding for several years beyond the expiry point of the great sultans earlier in the period.
Yeah. I love that. And one of my absolute favorite questions to ask guests on this show is, are there any hotly debated topics or questions that just you put historians of this era in a room together and everyone's just going to debate it?
That's a good question. I think that extent to which the Ottoman Empire bumped up against natural limits by the end of the 16th century, or whether under different circumstances it could have continued to expand.
I love that.
I look at those kind of fiscal imperatives, the way in which the Grand Viziers are complaining to the sultans at one point. Yes, you took these territories and it looks good on a map, but I'm the one who has to make sure people are getting paid. And these hovels, these bankrupt and lowly villages that you've brought into the empire cost more to administer than they do generate in revenue. We're on a negative treadmill here. So could the empire have kept expanding if it had been able to get those rich territories we're looking at? The Americas or India, if it had been able to secure those one way or another, would that have given it a more stable foundation to build on to become even more powerful? That to me is the big open question.
Oh yeah, I would pay to see people debate that. Absolutely. And before we go here, I want to ask another question about if there's something that you kind of want people to understand or walk away from the book with an idea of, what would that be?
That history is broader and richer, deeper than perhaps we've come to appreciate. That that every culture in its own way, of course, focuses on its own history and puts itself at the center of the narrative. Everybody's the hero in their own story. Right? And for us in an English-speaking Western world, it leans towards those key figures who were clearly very important, vital to the process. But in doing that, we've neglected, I think, to incorporate the other key players during that period, because it wasn't just Western Europe. The Ottomans are conquering their vast empire. The Mughals move into India and set up its grandest dynasty to that point. Muscovy, which is modern Russia, begins its grand expansion eastward to take over pretty much the bulk of Eurasia, the heartland.
Yeah.
And the Manchu move into China and set up its greatest dynasty, the Qing. So all this is pretty much happening at the same time. It wasn't something exclusive to Western Europe. And there was great balance between these rival forces well up until the late 17th, 18th, even into the 19th century. There was no telling who was going to, as it were, win in this kind of confrontation. So the past was not some narrative from then until now. Things didn't have to play out the way that they did. Things could have been very different.
Yeah. And then, you know, just thinking about how all of these things could have changed things, but also it's so weird to imagine living in a world where the borders of different countries are changing so frequently. And, you know, then you get things like Prussia, which today, for people who don't study that area, is like, what even was it? A kingdom, a country, an area? Like, sometimes this, sometimes that. And it's hard to comprehend some of these entities that used to exist. Very interesting. So if you like the Ottoman Empire, if you want to learn about the Ottoman expansion, I would highly recommend this book. You can tell by the way you interview and the way you answer these questions. Very comprehensive. The book is a really, really good informative read as well. Once again, Cy Shepard, author of Crescent Dawn, The Rise of the Ottoman Empire and the Making of the Modern Age. You can find it anywhere you find books. Cy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. Real pleasure.
Yes. Okay. Bye.